Welcome back to the Shanti Ma Podcast. This is episode 20. Today we have a very special guest and story. My boyf, my partner, my twin flame. Bronson Lee Norton is a professional musician, athlete, podcaster, philosopher, bow hunter, and bronze medal recipient for bravery. He is the host of the Barbaric Wisdom podcast, as well as the founder of Moss and Blood, an apparel company for athletes and outdoorsmen. He's also a babe. In this episode, we dive into a story, an act of heroism that would forever change Bronson's life. After saving a woman from a violent sexual assault, March 26, 2015, Bronson fell into a darkness that he once believed he would never return from. From a once hell to a deeply enriched and full life now, filled with spiritual and emotional healing, and most of all, gratitude that has come now as a result of that very experience. We explore his journey with First Nations medicine, tools he uses to navigate the difficulties of life and himself, as well as his advice to others who may currently be at their rock bottom. His message and his story is incredibly powerful, so I highly recommend listening through to the end. If you enjoy this episode, please head on over to Apple and leave a review. Your reviews help to expand the show to a larger audience and in turn are greatly appreciated. If you find today's episode inspiring, remember to share it with others who may also need to hear Bronson's empowering message. Bronson Norton was walking to the gym in Vancouver's Strathcona neighborhood in March 2015 when he heard a woman's screams coming from inside a home. Norton stopped outside the house on Hawks Avenue, but believing it may be a couple having an argument, he wasn't sure what to do until he noticed the front door was open and again heard the woman's desperate cries for help. I walked in. The attacker was on top of the woman with a knife to her throat. She was being assaulted. And then from there, I just ran in and started swinging. Whew, it's hard for me to even read that.
Yeah, it's kind of strange even just listening to myself recite that to the news reporters 6 years later, because today is actually the 6-year anniversary of this significant event in my life and the lady that they're speaking about in that news article. So yeah, it's heavy stuff.
Yeah.
And I guess before we even dive into this, maybe we should probably give a little bit of context to the story.
Yeah, that's exactly where I was about to take this. You're so used to being a podcaster, you gotta be the interviewee now. For those of you who don't know, Bronson is also my partner. We've never done a podcast before, so this should be pretty interesting.
Yeah, it's very strange being on the other end of the interview. I'm actually not quite sure how to do this.
Well, guess what? All you gotta do is breathe through it and tell your powerful story. And I guess I wanted to ask you, how does it feel listening back to that all these years later?
It brings up a lot of different feelings, many that are heavy. I mean, you can even hear just bit of shaking in my voice talking about this stuff. Mm-hmm. So many years later, but a lot of good, actually, a lot of good feelings come from what has manifested as a result of this story. Not only in my own life, but I feel like this story that we're going to talk about also brings a little bit of hope for humanity and just the goodness of people, not only from the event itself, but from the aftermath of the event and the community in general.
Yeah, well, let me start off by saying that this article is why we're together. That makes me feel very emotional when I talk about that. So actually, this little snippet that I just read was from an article in 2017 that I had seen on Facebook. And I was like, wait a minute, I know Bronson from elementary school. And I was like, oh, what's this? And I read it and was so moved by your bravery, because so many people don't want to get involved. They don't want to, you know, they don't want to get hurt. And for myself, as a survivor of domestic abuse, how many times, and this was why I reached out, was how many times you feel when you're in those moments desperate and you wish that someone would come to your rescue, and most people don't. And so I reached out because I just felt in my heart like I had to reach out to you. And then the rest is kind of history from there. But it's definitely, you know, the ripple effect. So before we get into some of that, let's have you explain a little bit about what happened for you that day.
Sure. So March 26, 2015, my whole life kind of changed, and not just my life, but the life of other, of the woman that they're speaking about, and the life of I think many other people in the community that were directly affected by this situation that happened. And so I'll just kind of take you from the beginning, I guess. That day on March 26, I was walking to the gym in Strathcona, Vancouver, and I happened to take a stroll down a side street that I don't normally walk down, but I wanted to go and stop at a store that I knew was down there and get something to eat. But I happened to come across a house in my neighborhood, and I could hear a woman screaming coming from that house. And the door was open, and I stopped for a minute just to kind of assess out the situation, because at first I thought maybe this was a domestic abuse, or there was just a very bad argument that was happening in the home. I didn't really know what I was walking up on exactly, but it sounded bad. And so through kind of the midst of those screams that I heard that day, and the struggle that I heard that was happening, I heard help. And so I decided, well, not so much decided, but I intuitively took the next step, which was to go inside the house and find out what was going on. And I came upon just a very horrific scene that I hope that nobody would ever have to walk up on. And the woman that they're speaking about, in this news article, was being raped at knife point in the house. And so when I realized what was going on, I just immediately ran in, and I started swinging, like the article says, started fighting the man that had her, I guess, restrained in the kitchen, but he had her at knife point at that point when I ran in with a knife to her throat. And I managed to partially knock him unconscious for a few seconds, and then he got back up and I dragged him outside. And at that moment, that's when I started screaming for help from anybody who was around, because this was right in the middle of the day. So people were out mowing their lawns. People were, you know, playing with their kids in the neighborhood. You know, people were playing basketball across the street. Another lady was walking her dog, and just dragged him out into the middle of the grass in front of the townhouses that were there, and called for help, and some other men ran over and held him down, and just so happened that some police officers were driving by, and so some others ran over and called for the police, and this the police came over and then restrained him, and I ran back over to the house, and this lady who had been attacked, who was severely battered. I won't get into the details. Some of that is in some of the other articles, but we'll leave that out just for
it's gruesome.
Not to trigger anybody. It's not necessary.
Yeah.
But it was just something that you never expect to happen to you.
Mm-hmm.
You never expect to happen to your loved ones or in your neighborhood even, or even in your city.
Yeah, like how did that happen? How did he come up to this house in the middle of the day? And if we're able to...
Well, according to some of the investigative reports, he had been knocking on doors earlier that day. And I guess at this time, her door was actually open, and he had just kind of walked into the house posing as someone who was collecting for donations. And again, I'm not going to get into the details, but that was kind of when the altercation started from there. And the assault lasted for about an hour, which is just awful. Oh. And like I said, this was in the middle of the day. So you're not really ever expecting anything like this to happen. And so, it all kind of happened in couldn't have been more than 5 to 7 minutes. But it changed lives forever.
Yeah. And I know that, and this is something that I wanted to ask you about, and I hope you don't mind sharing, but you had said that there was this one moment where you had locked eyes with him, and you could like, there was like a transfer or like this feeling of evil. And, you know, I guess it's hard for people to understand what that feels like, but I know that you really, after the fact, like you said, you walked away from there, and that day did not end for you there. It carried on.
No. Yeah. And I know what moment that you're talking about, 'cause you know, we've obviously, you know, we're partners, and we've gone through a lot of the aftermath together, and you know, but that moment that you're speaking about is of all of the things that I remember from that day, because it was such a flash, like, you know, adrenaline just floods your system like a drug when something so extreme like this happens. And so your brain kind of protects you by blocking a lot of this stuff out. But the one thing I remember from that scene so vividly was the moment that me and this this person that had attacked this woman made eye contact. And we didn't exchange words, but it felt like there was some kind of imprint that had on me. And like I had just touched pure evil for the first time. And that's the only way that I can describe it. But even after, years after, it always felt like there was this heavy, dark connection that I had with this person that I didn't know and only had a brief moment of interaction with, and will never again, because he'll be in prison for the rest of his life.
Thank God.
I carried that around for a long time, and I think a little bit of that I still do, and maybe always will. But that was significant for sure.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I also I also know that you had expressed to me about this spiritual priming, or this priming that you had experienced leading up to this moment. Like, can we get into that a little bit?
Yeah. Yeah, that's that part I have never been able to quite figure out, because every time that I start to try and explain it to myself, I start to feel like a little bit of a crazy person. But for about a month or two leading up to this, these circumstances, I deeply recall having a number of instances where it felt like I was experiencing hypervigilance without any reason to be experiencing hypervigilance. So I was super in tune with my surroundings, and it just started to feel like everywhere I went, I just had this kind of this anxious feeling like something was about to happen. Like, I need to be ready. Something is about to happen. And I would find myself, I'd be on the SkyTrain, and all of a sudden I was noticing the people who had sinister eyes, if that makes sense. Mm-hmm. And I would notice little things like people slighting each other, or someone unconsciously staring somebody down, or walking home just feeling a sense of paranoia that I couldn't quite understand where that was coming from or why it was coming from. I didn't really have any reason to worry. And it wasn't that I felt a sense of worry for myself. I felt a sense of worry for other people. And that felt like, in hindsight, like some kind of guiding hand that led me to this place where I just happened to be the one at that moment in time. And God forbid that it was anybody else. I'm grateful that it was me for whatever reason that I had to be there that day, because there was actually a woman that messaged me on Facebook about 2 weeks after this happened. And I didn't know that she was even there, but she was across the street walking her dog. And she told me, "I'm so glad that you went in there, because I was about to go in there. And I don't know if we would have been talking about two people coming out of this with or without their life."
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you had also mentioned that you had noticed in public places, men being violent towards women. You had seen that a few times. There was an incident where you had, you know, were intervening with a woman who was being assaulted or something by a male, like on the SkyTrain or something like that, or near the SkyTrain. I thought I recall you saying
that. That was the weird part, is that wasn't even the first time that month. Like, about 1 week before that happened, there was a scenario where it was actually a couple, kind of, you know, sort of they're a bit rougher looking pair, and they were fighting on the SkyTrain, and he shoved her to the ground, and I ended up getting in an altercation with this man because he had assaulted this woman. It was at 11 o'clock or so at night at the bus stop, and nobody else was there but me. And again, like, why is it me? Why is it always me that happens to be in these places? And my friends have said that before, you know. Like, I remember a couple years ago, my friend Kyle, he was just like, "Why is it always you that ends up in these situations?" And I've never been able to quite figure that out. And I don't know if I'd like to believe that there's a higher purpose for that, because with all of the circumstances that have proceeded since that event, and leading up to it, it felt like this was something that had to happen. Mm-hmm. And it felt like it was something that had to happen for me, almost like we've spoken about this before, but almost like the snake bite that the shaman has to experience to overcome his illness and extract the poison and heal himself in order to help other people. And I believe that has been my path. through all of this.
Definitely. Whew. It's heavy stuff.
It is. I was feeling like we were off to a rocky start, or I was off to a rocky start, because it's like, where do you begin? You know, where do we begin in the middle? Do we begin now? Do we begin in the midst of the chaos of the aftermath? And so it's just, it's been this crazy, I don't like using the word journey, because it's so much more than that. It feels like an initiation.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I mean, that's the thing. It is hard to know where to start. And the reality is, it is a heavy topic. It's heavy subject matter. It's not even easy to talk about, you know, like, we don't really talk about it. I mean, we have, but it's not really something you want to spend a lot of time dwelling on. But, you know, I've definitely seen you go through a lot from this situation. And I've seen you come out and sit across from me now. I see where you are. And I see how far you've come. And I feel so proud of you. But for people who don't know you and haven't had the opportunity to have these conversations with you, before we get into this rite of passage that this experience was for you, I want you to kind of dive into your mental health afterward, and that, you know, dark place, the depths that this took you to. And then we can kind of take people on the journey from there. What did that look like for you?
Sure. Yeah. I mean, it's been quite a long road. You know, it's so, after that happened, it was just a lot of mixed emotions that I couldn't even explain or describe, because, you know, one, for about 10 days after that event, I had just such a surge of adrenaline in my system that I felt like I was on heroin. Mm. You know, I was just functioning on a different level. You know, the only thing that I could do at that time was just go for walks. I couldn't sit at home. I couldn't talk to friends because I didn't know what to say. Couldn't talk to my family. And so I would just go for walks, and I was just experiencing this kind of internal, it's hard to describe. I went deep inside myself at that time, but the only way I could really describe it, and I think I've described it like this before, was that it felt like I was a ghost, and everybody was just going about their lives, and I was amidst the excitement of life and the excitement of the city, but nobody could see me, and I was seeing people differently than they could even see themselves. And that's the only way that I can really describe it. It probably doesn't really resonate with a lot of people, but it I felt like I was looking around and seeing people and just knowing the fragility of life and looking at the crowds and looking at the bustle and people kind of going about, you know, their superficial ways, and just thinking to myself kind of like, you guys just don't know. You just don't know how close you are to the end. You just don't know. You know, you don't know what, you know, it's like I could see our collective unconscious ignorance to the fragility of life, if that makes sense. And so that was kind of just the week after. But then after that, things just started to spiral big time for me. I kind of, that event happened, and, you know, everyone was calling me a hero, and, you know, was getting all these beautiful messages from hundreds of people that I didn't even know, people that knew me on the news, people that I knew from high school, people that were from my music scene, you know, friends, family. And I just could not see the good in this at that time. Mm. I just could not see it. It was just like, what are you guys so happy about? You know? And that was just, that veil of darkness had come over me. I didn't see myself as a hero. You know, I was just, I saw this as something that happened and life will go on. But it was through a different lens at that point. And that's kind of where I got very, very depressed. I didn't realize that I was dealing with post-traumatic stress disorder at that time. I thought I was over it, you know, but it was actually that I was just numb to everything. It wasn't that I was over it. My capacity to express happiness and love and joy was gone for years after that.
Yeah, the closest thing that I can even come to trying to understand that feeling. And I remember this was when you and I were just friends, and I had called you because I was like, there's nobody else who will understand this feeling other than you. So I had this weird contrast too, because 2 months before this, I was sitting in the room with the Dalai Lama, and I was listening to his teachings and feeling what that felt like to be in the presence of, you know, somebody so holy. And then flash forward, and that was in India. Flash forward, I came home, and I had gone with a friend for support. She was a victim in a serial rape trial. And I went with her, and I remember sitting in that room, and there was this one moment, like, I had tunnel vision. Like, it was so hard to be in the room and hear the story, and then this man or monster who is, I think, being tried for, like, I think it was like the 70th woman, he turned around and he looked at me. And we had this moment where we made eye contact for almost nearly a week after that. I could feel no joy. I remember going for a walk and the sun was shining. I couldn't feel the sun. I couldn't feel the heat of the sun. It was as if every bit of joy and love had been stolen from me just in that one moment. And so I had known, because you and I had started developing a friendship, and I had reached out to you because I was like, Bronson is the only person who's going to understand this. And that's the only part of me that would be able to relate to what you went through. So I can't even imagine even anywhere close to what that would have been like.
And that's kind of the dilemma of this, you know, I guess this is the hero complex, because people are expecting a lot of you after that happens, you know, and they don't realize it, because after that, you know, it's like you're seen as a person of strength, of bravery. You know, I received the award of merit from the Vancouver Police Department. Mm-hmm. I received one of the highest civilian awards for bravery from the Governor General of Canada. And even after all of that, like, those were brief moments of, you know, those were brief moments. That's all I can really say. Mm-hmm. Of elevation, I guess, and pride. But even with all of that, you know, it's, you're kind of, it's almost kind of expected that because of your ability to act in the moment that you will just plow through this unaffected. But, and I think that's what I thought too. I thought that I was not going to be affected by it the way that I was. And so I just carried on, and I suppressed any of the things that I should have known or should have gotten help for the post-traumatic stress disorder. But I just kind of avoided addressing that at all because, yeah, like I thought, well, if I can handle that, I can handle this. Like I'm good. Mm. Moving on. And I wanted to move on at that point with my life, but moving on in a way that I wasn't facing the aftermath.
Yeah, well, you know, that's the thing with PTSD. We now know that apparently in brain scans, trauma shows up the same way as a brain lesion. So it's actually an injury to the brain. So long after the threat is gone, you know, or let's say long after the fire is gone, that smoke alarm is still ringing. And that part of the amygdala, the brain, it's now changed. And that's really hard to live with because now you're constantly in a state of it's not safe, there's threat. And that's, I mean, let's talk about how that affected your relationships at the time, jobs, because I mean, I came in 2 years after that incident.
Yeah, definitely. I was going through relationships, you know, like clockwork. And a lot of that was because of the state of mind that I was in. I was also not settling for great partners. And at the same time, I was not showing up even in those relationships, whether they were healthy relationships or not. So my go-to response with the post-traumatic stress disorder was anger. A lot of people react to it differently. Some people get massive amounts of anxiety to the point where they're just crippled by it. They can't leave the house because they're in so much fear. For me, because of my nature, that aggression was what protected me and protected this woman in this volatile situation. So The way that I defaulted, or my brain defaulted to, for self-preservation, was more aggression. And I wasn't a violent person, but I had that capacity for anger and I have that capacity for violence. So that's how it came out in violent words, you know, violent tones, you know, just very manipulative arguer.
Just rageful.
Rageful. And not just towards people, but like the world and myself. Like I was not kind to myself either. You know, I didn't think much of myself anymore, really much of anything. And so, and like you were saying, like these are all effects to the brain. Like you were saying with your amygdala actually grows when you experience a traumatic event. It physically grows in size. Now I believe the amygdala, once you're back into a normal state, will shrink back down. But there is another part of the brain, and I don't recall exactly what the name of that part of the brain is. It also grows, but it physically will not return to its original size. The brain is actually permanently changed at that point after such trauma. And so that just continued. I not only was I having a difficult time in romantic relationships, but even just friendships. You know, I play in a number of different bands, and my music is still the most important thing to me that I do. But at that time, I was in the middle of recording a record, and I was just at odds with everybody, you know, all of my friends. I almost got to the point where they had to sit me down and it was like, I can't do this anymore, man. We can't deal with you. It's like, and I knew what they were trying to say, but it's like, if you don't fix this problem, like, we don't want to kick you out, but you're out. Right. We can't do it anymore. And so that in itself was a wake up call for me. Not the wake up call, but it was one of the pieces that started to get me to start to look at this as, man, like, there's more going on here than I'm admitting or I'm aware of.
Definitely. Oh, so for you, the journey upward from this, what were some of those pieces?
Well,
like, what was it where you were like, I cannot live like this anymore and I need to do something about this? What was that for you?
Well, in, I think it was about, it was actually a few months before we met. And
we met because we met in grade two.
Where we met as adults.
Yeah.
I actually didn't like you back then.
But I didn't like you either.
We
we seriously did not like each other in elementary school.
Eternal adversaries. but it was at the point where, you know, I just got to, like, I got to a place where it was too dark to ignore. And I realized after a certain point that I couldn't remember the last day that I didn't think of the least painful way to kill myself. And that's real. Even just saying that, it's just like, to think that that's where I was and where I am now, I feel so bad for that guy, but I don't really know him anymore. And I'm grateful for that. And so the path upward has been long, but, you know, that's kind of like a few months after that, we met, and, you know, honestly, that was a big part of the change that began to happen. You know, we started practicing meditation together as friends. Like, we were just friends at this point still. That was shortly after I think you had reached out to me. Mm-hmm. And we started doing meditation together and a few other things, you know, like, we were just kind of playing around and with some sort of spiritual stuff and just kind of having fun doing magic or whatever.
Yeah. I was introducing you also to some of the, like, yogic, you know, Hindu traditions that I knew. I was sharing some of that kind of stuff with you also.
Yeah. And at the time, I didn't even really know if that was for me because I was so stiff, you know, like, we would sit down for, like, you try to show me a yoga move or whatever. And I just realized, like, I was frozen. Like, I couldn't express any kind of freedom, you know, freedom to move, freedom to rest, freedom to even, you know, be silly at that point. And
I'm thinking of that party I brought you to.
Yeah. And, like, you took me to some, like, crazy BDSM, EDM sex party, which I was just so insanely uncomfortable with at the time.
Wait. I didn't bring you to a sex party. Because, like, hang on a second. Your parents are probably going to listen to this. Tom and Donna, I did not bring your son to a sex party. No, actually. Hang on a minute. We were friends and I liked you. and I had friend zoned you because I was trying to make up my mind how I felt about you, and I wanted to take you out of the friend zone. And I was like, okay, I want to dress really sexy. And so I had this plan. I was going to wear this like really sexy outfit, and I was going to wear a trench coat. And then it wasn't until I got to the party that I took off the trench coat and I was wearing this like sexy outfit. And but anyways, it was, for people that might not know, at this place in Vancouver. It's, I think it was called the Hindenburg. And Bronson, in order to be allowed in, had to be wearing some kind of leather. And let's just say it was like a Vancouver scene party. There was a lot of weird stuff happening. It was very entertaining. And it was a good time. And we had, but it, now that I know you, and I know how much you must have liked me to have allowed me to take you to some place like that.
Yeah, it was out of my comfort zone. And for sure. But like, and that was kind of the point that I was trying to make, is that was so out of my comfort zone. Like the idea of even going to a club to dance, I was not into it, you know? Like I didn't want to experience any kind of freedom, like I said. So yeah, like we ended up actually having a great time there, but I was uncomfortable the whole time. And part of that was because I was uncomfortable to be seen by people, you know? I didn't want to be seen. And in a literal way and a spiritual way, I guess. Mm-hmm. You know, I didn't want people to see my pain. I didn't go to social events at that time anymore. And so, you know, it was some of those things that I remember. There's a moment where we were doing a meditation, and you were kind of just walking me through a meditation. And for the first time ever in that last, like, I think it was 3-year period or whatever, I felt the darkness lift for a moment. It was for a brief moment, but that was when I realized how bad it had gotten, because for the first time in a while, I felt light for a moment. And so from there, it's been a very rocky up and down, up and down, up and down, but consistent climb to overcome that. And now, you know, I feel like just maybe in the last year and a half or so, it's really felt like I've got the reins on this stuff, and I'm happy. I'm happy with where my life is going. I'm happy to be using my social media platform and what I've learned through all of this to help other people and just share what I'm learning as I go, because I don't have all the answers. You know, I'm not a therapist. I'm not a psychologist, but I do feel I've become a practitioner of sorts, where you put these things into practice and things start to happen, and people don't realize how positive momentum compiles and how negative momentum also heads in that direction and starts to tumble. And mm-hmm. So what I was doing before is I was letting that negative momentum tumble. But when I started to pursue a higher good, it really started to take on a life of its own, and I didn't know where it was going. But that's kind of where we are now, through this very long process of you know, counseling was an aspect of it, you know, but a big part of it was also, you know, just finding some meaning in my life again. And that kind of started with our spiritual pursuits, getting in touch with, you know, my First Nations heritage and the First Nations. Medicine was one of the most significant things that set me on a higher path from there. And we've just been kind of doing this thing together. You know, you've been such a great support of mine, and I feel like we've been able to do that for each other and accept each other while not being our best, but also encouraging each other when we are doing our best. And so, yeah, it's been just an interesting ride because we've been kind of living parallel lives in a way before and during, by kind of going through these ups and downs in a relationship. You know, that's one of the hardest things to do, right? Most people don't bring two people with PTSD into a relationship and then try to make it work. Maybe it's one or the other, and maybe it doesn't work. But
yes, I do have PTSD for anybody who doesn't know that.
We've been
that's been an interesting journey for the two of us.
Yeah, and there's no shame in that at all, because you can overcome it. And yeah, that's just that's been a powerful, this has been a powerful relationship because of that, because we've been able to almost be that mirror for each other, you know, and see ourselves in one another. Also learn to accept that person, and by learning to accept that person for what they're trying to overcome, we've been able to also have a little bit of empathy for ourselves. I think it's been very helpful.
Yeah, you know, it's I've never ever had a good example of what, you know, a healthy relationship is supposed to look like. I've never had a, you know, strong male role model even in my life. And so, you know, we get into this relationship and it's so easy at the beginning to be like, oh, I'm so in love and everything is so good. And then you get into it and all of your stuff comes up. And, you know, I often say it's so easy to become self-realized and to reach a certain state of spiritual liberation when you have nobody to worry about but yourself. You know, somebody bothers you, a situation, a place. I don't like this person. I don't like this place. I'm out of here. You know, you can go. Yeah, of course. It's so easy to please yourself. You know, even just something as simple as, you know, not having to share a bed. We're even figuring out how difficult that can be sometimes. You have these big, broad shoulders. I have this painful, busted, broken up body. And sometimes your big man arms just like hurt my little tiny arms. Like that's even sometimes a, like, you know, and it's so funny. Like you get into this relationship and you start going through all of this and, you know, to muck through that and to come back to your center and to develop a spiritual connection with each other and to repair damage. Because even though you can see each other and you can see what the other person has been through, when you're triggered, you don't see that. And so to work through those things together in this relationship and to go through what we have and to kind of come back around and to have both found our own path, you know, where we've been able to encourage each other. And I know for myself, like your presence in my life and encouraging me, even encouraging me to do my first podcast, like, you know, just having somebody who has your back. I don't know. I know I definitely haven't had that before. So it's been interesting to see each other at our absolute worst and to still love each other and be now so excited to see each other finally at a point where it's like you feel good about who you are. You feel good about what you're doing. So I don't know. It's been really cool to see you on this journey. I know I've been having my own, but you on this journey, because it is like a rite of passage. Mm-hmm. Like you've been squeezed and squeezed. And actually, I think this would be a good segue to talk about these sweat lodges and those ceremonies, because I remember coming out of there and being like, that was as intense as ayahuasca for me. That squeeze and squeeze until you're about to burst. You think you're going to die. And then there's that release and the insights and the ahas.
Yeah, so it's exactly like that. And just to give people who don't know what a sweat lodge is, basically it's a First Nations ceremony where it's basically a dome that's made of sticks that's planted into the ground essentially and woven, and then blankets are put over top of it. And inside this pitch black dome is a pit. And so prior to the ceremony, there are other helpers who are stoking the fire and building a fire and heating up these piles of red hot rocks. And then the ceremony begins. Everybody climbs inside and they're sitting on the ground, cramped inside this very tiny space. It's pitch black. No air or light can come out. And then they bring in all of these hot rocks. And it's incredibly hot in there. And so when the ceremony begins, the medicine man will pour water onto the hot rocks. And then it fills with steam. And some of these get up to over 200 degrees sometimes. And so you can't breathe. It's pitch black. You know, you don't really know how long you're going to be in there.
It also feels like forever when you are in there.
Yeah, exactly. And it's, you know, your skin is just burning and you can't breathe because the air is so thick and hot. And so for, you know, it's like for many people, like that would cause a lot of panic. And so what that forces you to do is relax. Because if you don't relax, you'll just panic, you'll suffocate, and you got to get out. And so that forces, it's almost like a forced meditation where it's like, okay, I need to actually go inside myself to tolerate this heat and this discomfort and inability to breathe freely. And so you slow your breath down, you slow your mind down, you relax your shoulders so you can, you know, if you're like me and you can't sit cross-legged because your back starts hurting, it's like, that's not helpful either. And so you really have to just settle into yourself. Yeah. and ride it out. And as you do that, you just have this incredible connection to not only the people who are sharing this experience with you and the songs and the medicine and the whole experience itself, but like you were saying, it is like this release where you sit into it and then it's like, okay, I can do this.
Mm-hmm.
And if for anybody who's practiced meditation, it's kind of like that too. There's that period where you sit down and you're restless and you can't stop thinking and you can't sit down and your back hurts and your blanket isn't perfect and your couch is uncomfortable. And finally it's like, okay, stop thinking. And then finally you can relax. Then you can start to get some insight. And, you know, the interesting thing about the sweat lodges is it's kind of shaped like a womb. And that's the idea behind the sweat lodge is so when you leave the sweat lodge, you crawl out on your hands and knees. And it's essentially to signify birth, because when you start this life, you crawl out, you know, you're pulled out and you could come out crawling on your hands and knees like a baby soaked in liquid and sweat. And it very much feels like a rebirth when you leave the sweat lodge and you come out into the cool air. And you know, it's just it's amazing. And so you know, I had many we did a number of sweat lodges. I had many, you know, mystical type experiences and visuals, and whether they're hallucinations or something else, I don't know. But there's a lot that I gained from that. And it just felt like the healing started there. Mm-hmm. I can't really explain it in any other way, but I felt like something happened in those sweat lodges that gave me a sense of belonging and a sense of understanding and a feeling that I was moving towards something that deeply resonated with me, not only because I have First Nations blood and background, but I just, more than anything that I've ever tried, this medicine just spoke to me, and I gained a lot from it. And they even have been using sweat lodges to treat PTSD specifically for veterans, and they're studying this, and they're having incredible success with veterans who have been experiencing PTSD and using sweat lodge ceremonies to treat PTSD.
I did not know that. That's very interesting. I believe it. And I know that the sweat lodge ceremonies that we were going to, obviously, we're counting down the days that we can go back, because since COVID, we haven't been able to. But I know that the medicine man who was conducting the ceremonies we were going to, he had, I don't know how many people that were coming to his weekly sweats and were part of his community and were, you know, now like the firekeeper, the firekeepers. And they had been on East Hastings, addicted, heavily addicted to drugs, and that was their rehab. Because you sweat out, that what they had explained to us is you're sweating, but you're also like purging spiritual attachments, things that have a hold on you. I know that first ceremony we did, I felt like I was gonna die. I literally felt something in my chest that was like something trying to break free. Mm-hmm. And yeah, it's like I said, I would say that.
I mean, there was a guy there, and he was one of the people that would help with the fire. And, you know, he would help place the rocks inside the pit in the ceremonies, and he would sing songs. And he had been drug free for 15 years. And all of that was because he started going to the sweat lodge ceremony. Mm-hmm. So whatever happens there, you know, they're doing some kind of magic, whether it's just giving people a place to go so that they're not, you know, trapped with their own thoughts, giving them a sense of community. You know, and there's something that happens inside the sweat lodge ceremony that's just incredible, where you don't know a lot of people's names, you don't speak to each other inside the sweat lodge, but there is a sense of there is a collective strength that you get sitting in there, and you can feel it, that everyone is there for the same purpose, not only for themselves on their own path to heal, but to also hold space for everyone in there. And you see it, you know, like with you, for example, you were really struggling in that first ceremony, and the wife of the medicine man was sitting next to you, and just having that, you know, feminine energy close to you to, you know, just hold your hand, and like, you know, complete stranger, never met you before, but could feel that you were struggling and was there to support, and the other women that you were around you too. And they even brought, they even bring their babies sometimes inside the ceremonies, and it's called baby medicine. And they'll bring the babies in, and they'll put them close to people who maybe seem to be having a hard time, and just having that pure, innocent baby magic, you know, present in the ceremonies is sometimes enough to even just change the collective energy inside, you know, the ceremony. And so, yeah. And so that was just kind of the beginning of the path. And then I started to, research even more into, you know, Native American medicine. And I started reading about different plants, and then I started diving deep into my own history. And, that's just become a big part of my life that makes me feel very connected to, you know, a greater power, for lack of a better word.
Yeah. And, you know, I want to come back to the sweat for a second because, you know, it's like, yes, you have the medicine and the doctoring that's going on from the medicine man. But like you said, it's like this family, these brothers and sisters, like this strength that you feel in being a part of a tribe, and you are welcomed in like right away. Mm-hmm. And, you know, it's interesting because I feel often, at least, you know, I've done quite a lot of traveling, but here, at least where we're from in the Valley and in the West, I've never experienced that sense of tribe, that sense of community. Mm-hmm. Like often it's like, gosh, people judging each other, criticizing, tearing each other down. Mm-hmm. But like, it was such an interesting experience for you and I to go in there and to have this like tribe, this feeling of being like, it didn't matter if, you know, we were outsiders or the color of our skin. Like, you have First Nations blood, but we both look pretty Caucasian. Mm-hmm. But it didn't matter. Like, we were welcomed, we were accepted, we were held. And, mm-hmm. you know, I know we had experienced that a little bit when we were in Mexico, just like this feeling of, you know, you get into these other situations and you expose yourself to them and you're like, oh, wait a second. This is what it feels like to be, you know, a part of something and to be held. And then, you know, the other thing too that I wanted to mention is that coming back to the people that had been heavily drug addicted and had become sober in there, mm-hmm. what's at the root of drug addiction? 99.9% of the time, trauma. Mm-hmm. Right?
Traumatic experiences or some type of mental illness or childhood neglect. Like, most of this stuff goes back to your childhood. Mm-hmm. But even with that, you know, it's like I remember there's one particular man there, and he was also one of the main people that were helping with the ceremony. But he was obviously still currently dealing with some demons. And I remember in the first ceremony, in the second round, because each round they put in more rocks and it gets hotter and mm-hmm. hotter and hotter every time. And by the second round, this man was just screaming. And so you're already uncomfortable. And then somebody's screaming, but like, no judgment, nobody shouting him down, nobody, you know, allowing their own discomfort to worsen the situation. It's almost like while that was happening, everyone else was like, all right, mm-hmm. sit still, you know, sit up straight and mm-hmm. be silent and like let this person go through their and just people rose to the occasion. And, you know, it's when I say rise to the occasion, it's like you're not fixing this person's problem for them. You're letting them go through that process mm-hmm. of experiencing the agony, but with the trust of the community surrounding you to allow you to do that. And yeah, that was the first time I'd ever experienced something like that. And yeah, it's just, it's an enlightening experience for mm. sure. And that yeah. And so that was a big part of my own, you know, initiation, I guess. And from there, I started to just really dive hard into self-improvement because I now felt like the next direction was up, you know, once we began that first ceremony. And then we started trying other things. Then we started reading different books and I started listening to different podcasters. And, you know, I fell in love with a few people's different work, but like Jordan Peterson was a big one for me and his sort of message of personal responsibility was huge for me, because I was like, all right, you know, this is, I didn't ask for this, but this is my problem. And I need to be responsible for my own problem so that I can show up in my life the way that I want to, in the lives of others, in my family, in you, and my friends. And I've just reaped the rewards of that by really just making it my goal to be the best that I can be, you know, not only in business, but in our relationship. We've worked really hard at that together, to learn different coping mechanisms, different tools, and
gratitude mindset, is a big part of that. Perspective. Oh yeah.
Yeah. And just, and one of the big things is just learning to be grateful for these experiences, you know, these horrific experiences. Like, I'm not special, you know, I know we're talking about me in this podcast, but it's like, there's so many people that have these kinds of crazy, mm-hmm. you know, life altering traumatic experiences that just go about their day, and you don't know, and you'll never know, because nobody knew what I was going through. You know, most of my friends were like, well, it's been 2 years, this seems like he's over it, but they had no idea. And that's most people. And that's why you really need to pay attention to other people and see other people. And that's where that community mindset comes in, is because most people are dealing with something that you aren't aware of. And, but with that being said, everybody has the potential to turn that into something positive if they truly want to.
Yeah, you know, underneath it all, there's so many people that have some, like I always say, nobody gets to skate through life untouched or unharmed. Like, we all go through at some point or another something, whether that is cancer, whether that's sexual abuse, whether that's betrayal, or, you know, just the, you know, human beings, we suffer. And I've kind of come to my own little philosophy about it, that, you know, to be a human, it's like a rite of passage for the spirit soul. It's like what we go through in the sweat lodge. It's like what we go through in ayahuasca. And all of these traumas, all of these experiences, they squeeze us. And it's like this, like you said, the snake bite. Mm-hmm. You're being tested, and you think you're going to die. And sometimes you might even think about ending it altogether yourself, because you think you cannot overcome this. But I'm sitting across from you, and I know that it's possible for so. And, you know, anybody that's listening to this, if you are in that hell, it's so hard when you're in it to see a way out. And maybe you can't, but keep that little sliver of hope that, you know, it's the little things you do day by day that will eventually give you the power to overcome that. And I also often think of it as, like, you know, like the sun is being eclipsed. Mm. It's like the light is there, but it's being eclipsed, so you can't see it. It's just knowing that it's, you know, if you just keep, you know, one more day, a little step at a time, you can overcome this. You can come around, and you can, you know, sit across from somebody else and tell your story. And you have no idea the ripple effect that your story, your hardship, your struggle could mean for somebody. That could talk somebody else off the ledge. So, you know, I want to ask you this question. How, in your own words, would you say that evil, that even evil things or horrible things can have a positive ripple? Like, for you, relating that to this story, what are some of the positive ripples that you would like to, you know, share with other people who might be listening to this and being like, wow, I'm currently in hell?
Yeah. I mean, that's the hardest part, right? You can't see that until you experience the light again, right? You can't, it's almost impossible if you're in that dark a place to believe that things could get any better. You can always, sometimes you can't even believe that they could get any worse, but they do. And that's the hard part. But when you look at these situations, and there are so many incredible people out there, successful people that have this same story, you know, what it does really, I think, when you experience these trials in your life, is that it gives you the opportunity to grow in every sense of the word if you want to, or it can destroy you. But for me, you know, maybe if this event didn't happen, because I wasn't a clean slate before this, you know, I was depression in my life before, and you know, I had self-destructive habits like a lot of other people do, but maybe I would have just cruised through life if I didn't hit rock bottom. You know, maybe I would have been just doing something and not really having a very meaningful life, but not really having a really terrible life, but not really experiencing that zest for living that I have now. Because now, after seeing where I was and seeing where I am now, I never want to go back there. I can't go back there. And so every single day, I dedicate my life to chasing meaning. And I think what people mistake in their on their road out of this hell is that they're seeking happiness, but they're not seeking meaning in their life. Because people are unhappy all the time. Like, you're never going to be just happy all the time.
And no condition nothing, yeah, is going to be like, perfect.
Well, it's like, maybe you're happy right now, but then 3 weeks from now, boom, like, your grandmother gets cancer. Mm. Or 2 months from now, your mom gets coronavirus and ends up in the hospital. Or, you know, maybe a friend commits suicide. All three of those things happened in the last year within our families and our circles. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I am at the point in my life where, having had to experience those things this year and being able to be in a place where I could actually step up and be that person for other people, you know, I'm so grateful for the things that I had to go through and I had to overcome, because it made me so much stronger as a person. And so now what I look forward to is sharing what I've learned with other people and elevating other people. Like, people get so little encouragement and they need so little encouragement, but they never get it. And so that's really what I'm trying to do now, is motivate other people through my own experiences that, hey, like, this sucks right now, but you can make it through one more day. It's just one more day. That's all it takes. And then you just got to make it through one more day again. Little steps. And it's all these little habits and tools that you find, and you make that your goal is to uncover all of these tools in your arsenal. Mm-hmm. And just keep putting them in there. You know, it's like, you know, these are weapons that you get to throw inside a bag that you will combat the difficulties of life with. And that's really, really what it's been for me. And because I've been able to I guess, make my way out of the darkness. Now I get to actually enjoy life. Mm-hmm. You know, you have these realizations where it's like, you know, I can actually do anything. You know, it's hard to explain, but for people who carry this weight, I have so much pride in the fact that I can carry that weight. Mm-hmm. You know, that's what people don't usually think about when they're going through it, is it's like, oh my God, there's all this weight. It's like, how do I carry this? How do I carry this? Like, it's like, I want this weight off my back. It's like, no, it's like, you're the person who can carry that weight. Like, that's something. Even if there's nothing in your life, that's something.
Yeah, I remember I had that one day where I was feeling really discouraged and down. And you reminded me that strong people carry heavy things, and that, you know, even Jesus himself had to carry his own cross.
Yeah.
Bear
your cross.
Yeah. We all have our burdens. We all have our struggle. And, you know, and this is the thing that I have found in my own journey on the other side of things that's really helped me, is there's never going to be a perfect life or perfect condition. Like you said, people get sick, people die, all sorts of things happen. So, you know, you learn to know yourself, know your weaknesses, and take personal responsibility so that you can see the places in your life that you need to clean up, and then develop tools to navigate yourself in this world. Know yourself very well. Know how you respond and react to things. Like, both you and I have little tempers. So you have to know that about yourself, and know, okay, we need to take a time out, or I need to pause here a minute and breathe. I know that I need to go for a walk, or I need to write, or like have tools to navigate those energies that can work against you. And when you can do that, those energies can work for you. And I've definitely seen you do a ton of that. So, like, I know one of the first things that you and I started doing that was very helpful was our gratitudes. Mm-hmm. So just writing, and like, what are the things you're being grateful for? Because oftentimes, a sour mood can be changed by a little gratitude, which is perspective. What are some of the other things that you would recommend to somebody who is, you know, struggling to find their way through right now?
Yeah, I mean, gratitude's a good place to start. And like you were saying, like, you know, when you're in such a negative mindset, it's difficult to find things to be grateful for, because you think the world isn't happening for you. The world is happening to you. And something as simple as taking a look inside your fridge and being grateful for the fact that you can have lemon in your water today may set you onto a trajectory that where you start to notice other things that are grateful. It's like, okay, well, I've got lemon in my water today. What else do I have? Well, I've got a roof over my head and my heat is on and my internet works. There's lots of people that don't have heat. There's lots of people that don't have internet. So I'm pretty grateful for that. Well, you know, my partner annoys me sometimes and maybe they're grumpy, but it's
never.
Like, I'm living in a pandemic world where a lot of people are locked down and are completely alone, and I have somebody to go through it with.
And just someone to annoy you just a little bit.
Just a little bit. It's something to make life interesting, right? But yeah, for me, it was like getting disciplined and really creating as much meaning in my life as possible. And like, that really is the key, is discipline, because you're not going to want to do this stuff every day. And especially if you're in a negative mindset, you're not going to want to do this stuff every day. But if you just do it, at least make a list and something that's going to be attainable for you to begin with, because you don't want to set huge goals and then fail and then you just hate yourself because you're a failure and you don't do anything right. Mm-hmm. But it's like, all right, I'm going to get up at 5 o'clock every day this week, and that's my goal. Okay, I did that well. All I had to do was get up at 5 o'clock, set an alarm, and get out of my bed. And I honored myself by doing that. Okay, so now it's like, okay, I'm going to go. Maybe I don't like going to the gym and I find it really hard and I'm not motivated, but it's like, I'm going to go 2 days a week, every week, no matter what, no matter how I feel, I'm showing up to the gym for those 2 days a week. And you honor yourself. And then it's 3 days a week. And then it's 4 days a week. And then all of a sudden you're looking at yourself and it's like, oh my God, I'm making progress. It's like,
oh, I got a baby bicep.
Yeah. Are those abs? Like, I've never seen those before. And then it's like, okay, now I'm feeling a little bit more confident about myself. And I do advise to people, if they don't know where to start with your body. Like, that is the most attainable, tangible thing that you can start with towards improving your, not only your physical health, but your mental health, is to start with your body. It's like, I got all these messed up things going on in my brain, and I don't understand. Your brain itself is one of the most complicated things in the world that nobody has really quite been able to figure out how it quite works yet. But, like, you go to the gym, you exercise, you feel better, you come home, you do that for a few weeks, you look better. It's like, that's proof. That's tangible. I'm already improving. I can see it. I can feel it. And that's a good place to start. And I really feel that is the path to higher thinking, is to start actually treating yourself like somebody that you care about. You know, don't put poison in your body. You know, don't allow yourself to get...
That's what Jordan Peterson always says.
Exactly. To get weak, you know, because it's like, maybe I can't fix all these problems at once, but here's a problem. Mm-hmm. I'm going to fix that first, and then we'll find out what the other ones are from there.
Yeah, just one thing at a time. Master that. I know you're so good at getting up at 4 or 5 o'clock in the morning. You're nuts. I managed to do that for about like 3 weeks with you, and you literally had to pull me out of bed. And then flash forward, he tried to get me out of bed the other morning, and I like...
I took 3 or 4 slaps to the face by a half unconscious sleeping woman, but
I didn't even know what happened. I just knew I didn't want to wake up and there was something happening, and I did a and then the hand just did its own thing. You know, and the other thing too is that maybe you don't want to go to the gym. I mean, you can do, or maybe you can, maybe your gyms aren't open. You're living in a place in the world where gyms are not open. Mm-hmm. You know, you can do some sort of online, you know, YouTube has tons of Pilates and yoga or like at home workouts, but
lace your shoes up, man. Like, most people's excuse is that I don't know how to work out. You don't have to know how to work out. Like, do you have 2 feet? If you're lucky enough to have 2 feet, put 2 shoes on your feet and go outside and start walking and do 15 minutes, 2 days a week, 30 minutes, 2 days a week. Maybe you start jogging, jog, run, jog, run, jog, run. It's like, that is all it takes. And then it starts there and you're like, man, I'm feeling good. And it's like, what else could I do? See, if I could do this, what else could I do? I didn't know I could do this before, so... what more is there?
See, and this is the part where your masculine and my feminine are both so very much apparent. You're like, man the F up and put your shoes on and get going and put some dip in your lip and you better spit. And I'm, which by the way, I had to tell him he was not allowed to put a dip in his lip and spit before this podcast. Yeah,
I've been experimenting with clean nicotine for kind of cognitive enhancement and and focus, because I have trouble concentrating because I've had one too many concussions, or 5 or 6 too many concussions, but it does help. But yeah, we did have that discussion before this.
Yeah, and he also tried to convince, he's been trying to convince me to also dip, and I'm just like, I just don't want to. But you know, but okay, so like maybe, you know, you whatever. We've given you some tools for like YouTubing or walking or whatever. You want to walk, you want to be hardcore.
Yeah, I mean, I've got like that drill sergeant attitude. It doesn't have to be that.
Or, you know, you want to do yoga or you want to do Pilates or like, because depending on, you know, what your thing is. But, you know, the other thing too is like sometimes you just need to express yourself and you need to be heard. And if there's nobody that you have around you to hear you, write it down. And I don't mean write it in your phone. I mean, take a pen and a paper. It does something to your brain. Dump that out and then rip it up. How many times did you and I go and have fires and we would write down what we wanted to let go of and we would burn it in the fire and we would hold these ceremonies. We would throw cedar in the fire and we started getting more in touch with like our medicine and our power and releasing and setting intentions, you know, along the way.
Yeah, you're taking responsibility for that yourself, right? You're like, okay, so how do I feel today? What do I think today? It's like, well, those thoughts are gross. You know, you really want to carry that around all day? At least if you put it down on paper, you put it somewhere out of your mind and you don't have to think about it anymore. You know, if I really wanted to be depressed, I'd just go and read that thing this morning, but I'm not going to do that because, you know, why would I want to do that? But it's out of your mind. And you know, there's so many different strategies and many of them work differently for different people. But like you were saying, it's like whatever it is that makes you feel excited, really, or makes you feel something positive. It can be anything. Like if you love to draw, but you've been putting it off because you're just like, man, it's like, oh, dude, no, whatever. You know, it's like, that's just where you're at. Just doodle. Do something that makes you feel good once a day, every day, and just you start stacking your schedule. And, you know, now I'm kind of at the point where I have so many things that I enjoy doing that I don't have time to be miserable. You know, it's like my day is regimented and packed full of things that I enjoy between, you know, training and my own podcast and working on a business that I'd like to, that I'm going to have out in the next few weeks, and writing and archery and reading and us spending time together.
Magic day. We have one day a week that we call magic day, and that's our time. We put our phones away and we spend some quality time together.
Yeah. We're both busy. And I mean, you're busy, you know, you're now sharing your own experiences on your own podcast, and you know, we're doing very similar things, but it's like, that's what can happen. And you know, like, and maybe through your own experiences by just documenting it, you might help other people. You know not everyone needs to be a self-help guru to help other people, and that was kind of what my next point was going to be on how to make yourself feel better. Is no matter what, if none of this stuff is working, you're not feeling disciplined, you're not feeling motivated to exercise, you don't want to do a meditation, you don't want to write something down, it's like there's still the option to do something good for somebody else. And I promise you, no matter what, if you do something nice out of the goodness for your heart, even in a small way, for somebody else, there is 0% chance that you will not feel at least a little bit better after offering your service to somebody other than, you know, just serving yourself.
Yeah. I mean, sometimes it is that, you know, we're unhappy because we are being selfish. Sometimes we are thinking too much about ourselves, whether it's thinking too much about our problems or thinking too much about, you know, our own personal gains. Sometimes it does require get out of your own ass and ask the question, how may I serve? I did want to say something though. First of all, I really thought it was adorable when you said the word doodle. And the second, yeah. And then the second thing that I wanted to ask you is, what do you do to start your morning? For anybody who feels like taking the hardcore Bronson Lee way.
Yeah, I mean, not everybody wants to get up at 5 a.m., but I get up at 5 every day, 7 days a week. because it makes me feel like I had a small victory already to start the day. You know, I beat my alarm clock. My alarm clock didn't beat me. So there's all these little psychological tricks that you play on yourself to basically really, like, that's what it is. It's like I'm creating small victories for myself, and you gain positive momentum by doing that. So I like to start the day with...
And you put the alarm in the other room.
I do, yeah. Because I do not get out of bed easily. It's not that I really want to be doing this. It's that I have to do this. And, but yeah, I put the alarm in the other room. It's super jarring for anybody that's sleeping next to me and myself. But I put it in the other room because I don't have the option of just leaning over, hitting snooze, and go to bed. I got to get out of bed. You know, it's cold in the kitchen, and I got to shut my annoying alarm off. And so that's how I start my day. And then next, I've gotten really good about not jumping to my phone first thing in the morning. And so I'll sit down, and every morning I typically actually start with, it's actually a Navajo, prayer. It's called the early morning prayer. And, that's the first thing that I put in my brain before I even start my day. It's 3 or 4 minutes long. I'll listen to it. It's on YouTube. And it's just, there's something about that song that just makes me feel at peace. And so after that, I'll do about a 30-minute meditation. And that's just kind of sitting in silence, kind of calmly allowing myself to wake up. And then I go, I usually will train for about an hour, hour and a half, first thing in the morning before I go to work. And that's kind of like, that's the way for me to feel solid before I have to dive into the work stuff and then opening my phone to social media and all these other things. Cause that's part of it. You know, it's like, it would be great if you could just avoid that. But I believe that social media can be a very valuable tool if you're using it properly and using it for greater good or to advance yourself in different ways. And create opportunities for yourself. Like, social media has been amazing for creating opportunities for me and how I've used it. Same for you. But it's just having a healthy relationship with, you know, all of the different, faculties of your life. And so that's the best way to set yourself up for a good day is a proper morning routine. For me, at least, that's what's really been helpful. So,
mm-hmm. Yeah, you're really good at that. I was literally just telling you the other day about how I'm so proud of you and that I want to rise that early, and I was at a point.
Oh yeah, we were doing our morning runs for mm-hmm. quite a while.
But then I started having some stuff go on with my body. I do suffer from like chronic pain, and then I started going through some treatments and my body has just needed more rest. So like that's the other thing too. Like, you know, with all of this being said, and we're going to wrap this up pretty soon here, it is not about being perfect. It's about, you know, doing your best, trying every day to do something to improve yourself and your life, and to work towards the things that make your life meaningful. But I mean, this idea of perfection is, it's not possible. So try to just do your best. And also, something that can also be helpful, and this is the part where the feminine part of the conversation on my half comes in, it's like, also realize what you've been through. If you hear your story played back to you through somebody else's mouth, you would probably have a different perspective on that person and what they've been through. But we don't have that same level of compassion for ourselves usually, because often we're just so sick of it because of the suffering that you go through from it. You're just like, ugh, if I could surgically remove this, I would. But you know, let go of the perfection. You'll never be perfect. None of us will be, but just try to do your best. So Bronson, I want to ask you, what did this experience teach you about yourself?
I mean, it's not one thing. It's taught me so many things, but I think what I've chosen to take from it is that it's a tough question. You know, fundamentally, I think what I've gained from this is the ability to believe in myself. And that sounds so cliche, but it's like when you learn to appreciate that you are somebody who can walk through fire and come out on the other side unscathed, it really does feel like a superpower. But I feel that that is a choice. I think that everyone has that choice to make. And I don't believe that everyone will go through their life unaffected. That's not what I'm trying to say with that metaphor. It's that, you know, like you said earlier, like, be proud of the fact that you can carry that weight. And if you can do that, like, how much more could you be? Because that may be the hardest thing that I ever have to go through. But it's like, okay, if I can do that, well, what else am I capable of? What else am I capable of pushing through and overcoming? Because that whole process, you know, while I was doing it, every step of the way, I was like, is this ever going to end? And it's like, realize it's never going to end. Like, this journey that you're on, for lack of a better word, is never going to end, and it should never end. Like, I believe that is the meaning of life, is the continual seeking of improvement, like, and having rich experiences and bettering yourself and becoming as much as you could possibly be. Like, that's really what I think life is. I think it's becoming as much as you can possibly be in this lifetime. And so that's really been what I've taken away from it. And that's how I want to live my life every day. And it's not that I want to share this to be idolized or to be someone who tells other people what to do. It's like, these are just things that I'm working through, and I will continue to talk about these things because I will continue to work through things for the rest of my life, and everybody will. And so part of my purpose now is just sharing that, because you never know who's listening. And anybody who's listening to this, like, I know that you have a story that you could be sharing that might help somebody else. And part of that is just sharing how you're riding that wave. Mm-hmm. So yeah, it's just like people, not enough people believe in themselves. And that's what this experience has really taught me, is how to believe in myself.
It's well said. You hear that, folks? Be a humble student. Start with yourself, and then your friends and your family. And then once you master that, you can go out into this world and do big things. And the only thing that's really getting in your way is you. So find a way through. Find a way through. So where can people find you, Bronson? I know I can find you right across the room.
I know. You say that in a super creepy way.
I'm actually really good at being creepy.
Yeah. Several times a day I feel uncomfortable in my own home. But I mean, you can, best way to probably find out what I'm doing is on Instagram. So it's just at Bronson Lee Norton on Instagram, at Barbaric Wisdom on Twitter, and Bronson Lee Norton on YouTube. I host a podcast called the Barbaric Wisdom Podcast. You can find that on YouTube and any of the audio platforms that are out there, pretty much Apple Podcasts, Spotify, that kind of thing. And yeah, so that's where you can find me if you're interested in anything else that I've might be doing in the future. And yeah, I just want to say thanks to my lovely partner. You're a great interviewer. We've never actually done this before, so it was a little bit of an interesting dynamic, but yeah, it was fun.
Well, thank you. Thanks for coming on the show and sharing your story.
Anytime.
And love you.
Love you too.
And we're sending love to all of you as well. And thanks for tuning in. Thanks for tuning in to another episode of the Shanti Ma Podcast. Until we meet again.